Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, Dwight Howard is a Laker again. We still trying to act like Serena and Sharapova is a rivalry. And also, we'll wrap up The Right Time Book Club with Mike Freeman, author of Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero. But first. Yo, man, Andrew Luck just went out there and quit his job the other day. Y'all see that? No, I mean, retiring. Yeah. But for real, he just went out there and quit his job. I don't blame him for quitting his job, but he went out there and he quit his job. And here he is, by the way, saying that he's about to quit his job.
And it certainly isn't how I envisioned this or planned this, but I am going to retire. This is not an easy decision. Honestly, it's the hardest decision of my life, but it is the right decision for me.
I have to say, I have been amazed by the level of judgment that people have had about Andrew Luck deciding that he was going to retire. It seems pretty clear that he had talked to all the people, all the relevant parties, and let them know that this was coming. I think he wound up being done a disservice by whoever called Adam Schefter and put that out there before Luck himself had the opportunity to share the news, because I do think that that created a bizarre set of circumstances where they're playing this preseason game. He's on the sideline. The people in the stands know that he has retired, but he hasn't had a chance to say it. So now he's just out here getting booed. And, it was a lot there. And I think it put him in a bad place. And I know there's been a lot of speculation as to who it was that leaked it. I mean, I would assume that it would be somebody from the Colts side. I honestly have no idea. But I do think that they did him wrong by putting him in that situation where his last memory of walking out of that stadium as a player, even though he wasn't in the game, but his last memory of walking out of that stadium as a player is going to be getting booed by fans. Fans who seemed up until that point to love him a lot and to hang all their hopes on him. And then they just berated him basically on the way out. And the thing that I find strange about the judgment is, does Andrew Luck owe you money? Because like when people owe me money and they make decisions that either like cost them money or interfere with their ability to get money, I immediately think to myself, so when are you going to give me my money? Right? But Andrew Luck doesn't owe me money. Gabe, does Andrew Luck owe you money?
No, he does not.
All right, you think he owed anybody in that stadium money? Because I don't think he owed anybody in that stadium money. And he didn't owe you money. Why do you care if he goes to work? I personally have a spectacular level of respect for anybody who has lived their lives in such a way that allows them to wake up one day, look around and be like, you know what? I ain't got to do this no more. I quit. I'm just not coming back anymore. Why are you not coming back? Because I ain't got to do this no more. I remember this was in 2013. I guess it was around March, April, somewhere. There must have been March. All right. And I didn't have a full-time job at the time, but I was doing like, around the horn appearances and stuff like that. I'm doing those 2, 3, 4 times a week, depending on when it was. So I didn't have a day job, but I still had work to do. But I knew I was going to be getting a job soon. And once I got the job, it was going to be real consuming. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just not going to do around the horn or anything else for a month. And that month turned into 2 months. You know why? Because it was so good not having a job, but not needing the money. All right, I got my bread was fine. I was doing all right. My expenses were pretty low. I ain't need that nonsense, man. I ain't even go nowhere for the most part. I just sat around my house. I'd wake up. I'd take a shower. I'd sit down on the couch and I'd watch TV all day long. All day long. I wasn't out here chasing no dreams. I wasn't out here like, wow, there's all these projects I wish I had time to do. Hell no, it wasn't none of that. You know what I was doing? I wasn't going to work no more. That's what it was. And I remember I went to, I went up somewhere I used to go, like a radio station I used to do some work at. And I just went up there to see some people. And I was there and the woman that was working the desk asked me what I've been up to. And I was like, I've just been sitting at the house doing nothing. And the look of jealousy, and like not jealousy like she was mad at me, but like she really looked at me like, yo, I really wish I could just sit around the house and do nothing. Because the whole reason she was showing up at that job and sitting at that desk is because she had to. Andrew Luck does not have to do that. There's so many dudes who are in this league right now who have to do these things. They have to keep going out there and subjecting themselves to the physical abuse because for whatever reason at that moment, they cannot let that job go. Whether it be because of what the job does for them on the inside, how it makes them feel, how it defines their existence, or simply because the rent due. Like Adrian Peterson, where all that money about Adrian, I mean, the stories about Adrian Peterson owing people money. Now we know why it is that Adrian Peterson got to keep coming to work. Same thing I was talking about Andrew Luck. He don't owe you money, so you don't care if he go to work. There's people that care if Adrian Peterson go to work. He apparently owes them money. And so one of the greatest running backs of all time is going to keep dragging himself out there trying to get that bread because he needs it. Andrew Luck looked around and just said to himself, I don't have to do this anymore. Therefore, I am not going to do it. And what he talked about that I found to be interesting was just the idea that he was basically like, you know what he made football sound like? He made football sound like making your bed. Gabe, do you make your bed every day?
I do.
Okay. I've grown over time to be more of a bed maker in my life. Having a stretch where you live with a woman will make you more of a bed maker, right? I became more of a bed maker. But my problem with being a bed maker before was very simple. All I'm going to do is get back in it. Like, that's all it felt like. Like, all I'm going to do is get back into bed. Now, that's not the greatest logic in the world to use, but we're talking about making your bed. And so it's just like, nah, man, well, I'm going to straighten this thing right back up just so I can get back in. And ain't nobody coming over to see this. Like, I felt like it was just a presentation. I ain't doing this. That's what football sounded like to Andrew Luck, where basically with these injuries, he was doing the equivalent of getting out of bed, making it up, only to get back in the bed again. And what the bed was for him was getting his body cracked repeatedly. And that's what it was for him. He's like, yo, I'm hurt. I go work really hard to get back from being hurt, and rehab is a miserable process for anybody who's been through it, they know. And that's just like regular people rehab. God forbid what it is for these cats out here playing on a professional level. And he's like, hey, man, I get hurt, I rehab, and then you know what happens after I rehab? I come back out here, and I get hurt again. And so then I go rehab, all so that I can come out here and get hurt again. And he said that being hurt all the time made him a miserable person. He said it made him very unhappy just how it felt to always be hurt, to always physically be in pain. He just couldn't do it anymore. And so he's just like, no, why am I going to keep doing this? And he said that, and this is before this one, but he had made this point before that he dealt with those injuries before. And what he had to learn was how to define himself outside of football. He went and got married, you know, and all the things that come along with that. And he realized like, hey, man, I got a life for myself that is outside of playing football. And if playing football is causing me unhappiness and I have these other things that make me feel better, well, I'm going to go ahead and do those things. I got bread. I got my money. I'm straight as it relates to that. I'm good as it relates to my money. So I don't have to do this. I'm not going to do this. I can't understand why that ain't something that everybody in that stadium would applaud, because every single one of those people wishes they could walk into their job and quit. Every single one. How many of y'all at your job? A lot of y'all listening to this at your job right now. How many of y'all are truly at that job because you want to be at that job? And that includes, by the way, some of y'all who actually love your jobs, who really, really, really enjoy your jobs. You are at that job because for some reason you feel like you have to be at that job. Maybe you stacking for the kids' college fund, right? Maybe you sending money back to your parents. Maybe you just single and broke and just need to keep a roof over your head, whatever it is. But the reason you going to work tomorrow is because you want to come back to an air-conditioned home after you get off work. Andrew Luck is going to come home to his air-conditioned home, but you know what? He ain't got to go to work no more. Is that not the American dream? I remember this dude, what was his name? Jim Riggleman. He used to be the manager of the Washington Nationals. And he was trying to get an extension. They wouldn't give him an extension. Like, the Nationals at that point had outperformed anybody's expectations. And they told him they wouldn't give him an extension. He wanted an extension. He's quit. He left and went to a hotel bar, posted up and started drinking with people and taking pictures and everything else. He's like, man, I don't need this. I don't. Is that not the dream? Tell me how that is not the American dream. Like, so for me, I can tell you this, right? Like, I work. I make pretty decent money. I get my stack on, right? And it's a little tricky for me because I get my stack on, but I'm single and I don't have children and I don't expect necessarily to be single and childless forever, which means I probably need to get some bread. But you crazy if you don't think I sit around here like, damn, what is my cash out point, right? Like, what is the point that I can walk away from this if I want to? Not because I don't like my job, but I mean the point where I can look up and I can say, I don't have to do anything I don't want to do. You understand what I'm saying? That I don't have to do anything that I personally do not want to do. Because most of our lives are dictated and governed by the things that we have to do. It's capitalism, after all. That's the way most of our lives are dictated. Nah, man. Andrew Luck reached the point of what freedom is in this capitalism, which is I don't have to get on the hamster wheel anymore. I don't have to be part of the rat race anymore. I can move on with my life. I admire that. And I also admire for him, just from talking to enough former athletes about how hard it was for them to retire and how hard it could be for them to find definition in their lives and to find meaning, because so much of what they've done have been poured into football, because to get to the places that they got to required such a single-minded focus, like such a level of myopia, that what do you do when it's done? What do you do when you walk away? Like, who are you? If you're not Andrew Luck, franchise quarterback, who are you exactly? And these are the questions that a lot of guys have struggled with answering, struggle with figuring out, because their value to the larger world has always been dictated by the idea that they are football players. And Andrew Luck looked around and was like, well, I mean, maybe that's my value to the larger world, but I got a little world that I care a lot more about than this outside world. And now I am going to focus on this little world. That's what I'm going to do. And that is truly, legitimately, 100% admirable. And I think something that people ought to consider when they think about this. I ain't heard a football player call him a quitter yet. I ain't heard anything from the guys on his team referring to him as any sort of a quitter yet. The only people that seem to have anything to say about him in that regard are people who don't play football. That's it. People who don't play football. Like, it's wild even seeing former athletes talk this way about Luck. Like, not football players, but I'm just like, yo, what are you talking about? Like, what is this? I saw somebody talk about, you know, the idea of Luck as a competitor. And they're like, no, the ultimate competitor. I think it was Kent Sterling, works out of Indiana, whom I like. He's always been very good to me. But he was like, yeah, I think a firefighter is the ultimate competitor, not Andrew Luck. And I asked this question. What is a firefighter competing against? Like, that's not really a competition, right? Like the firefighter ain't had also like win some, lose some. No. That's not what this is. Like, yeah, we get it. Being a football player, maybe not as important to the universe as being a firefighter. The high end of the risk of being a firefighter may be higher than the high end risk of being a football player. However, and Gabe, you let me know if I'm wrong here, because I don't know that many firefighters, but I know that when I be watching stuff they show about firefighters, you see a whole lot of clips of them sitting around playing cards waiting on a call. That ain't how football works. Now, even a slow day at work in football means somebody going to be hitting you in your kidneys. Like, when they ran through all these injuries that Andrew Luck had to that point, the lacerated kidney. And by the way, people love to talk about, he had a lacerated kidney. He was peeing blood after the game. What the hell did you think a lacerated kidney meant? Like, I think people just love the idea of getting out here talking about, he was peeing blood after the game. I said peeing blood. Again, the dude had a lacerated kidney. I know what lacerated means. I know what kidneys do. I understood there was probably blood in his urine. Wasn't that hard to figure out. Didn't need to walk you all the way up to that, guys, just so you know. But dude had a torn labrum, now this calf thing that they just couldn't figure out what to do with and everything else. Man, that just sounds arduous. That sounds difficult. That sounds miserable. And for the man to be able to take that moment and walk away, I ain't saying that sounds like a hero because that's being dramatic, but that sounds like a man who exists with a level of freedom, both financially and with his own mental constitution and with his own personal confidence within himself. That sounds like a man that I think most of us wish that we could be like, because that is a man who is secure in himself, secure in his place, and his pockets are secure with both. I salute him for that. Now, with that in mind, let's think about ourselves here for a second. Us, Right Town Community. Gabe, I feel like we need a name for all. Do we need to come up with a name for the people who listen to this? Like Right Timers? Is that what we need to call them?
That is a good name.
Could work. I don't know. It feels a little corny, but I feel like we need a name. Everybody got to have a name now. Everybody got a crew. But those of y'all who down with the crew, y'all know, you know, Andrew Luck has been a part of the Right Time back to when it was a radio show. And Andrew Luck is leaving the NFL. That also means something else will be leaving us. Go ahead and press play, Gabe.
Wow, this is really, really, really tough for me. This day has been a long time coming. First of all, I'd like to thank the Right Time with Bomani Jones listeners for believing in me and hoping that I would be able to turn this around. But after thinking about this and talking with my family, I realized now is the right time. I made a joke there for me to announce formally that I am in fact coming on home. Yes, every day after I read a good book and I look in the mirror and I can see it, you know, I look at my highlights and I can see it. I can see the moon roof up there and I know my hair is receding on the sides. I can see it. And it was about time to come on home. I have plenty of hair. My hair grows, as you can see, it's on my face. So it's there and the want to and the passion and desire to grow my hair. It's still there, you know, and it hadn't waned. But I realized it was just time. I was growing the little island up there at the top of by my forehead, and I just knew I couldn't perform at the level that I wanted to. And you see the size of my head. It's kind of hats just don't really fit me. So this is tough. Yeah, and I when I was out there on the field and without my helmet on, yeah, I can see looks. And now I'll be lying to you, say it didn't hurt because it did. But what will I be doing next? that's actually a good question. I'm looking forward to exploring things, changing diapers. That's going to be exciting for me in the next phase of my life. And I'm looking to try new things. I heard the what are the kids into now? The Facebook. I just got a smartphone not too long ago, so I'm looking into that. And yeah, that's going to be exciting for me in the next chapter of my life. So yeah, so thank you to Bomani. You asked great questions throughout. Thank you for Shannon Penn for your horrible impersonation of me. I still laugh at that each and every day. So that's what I'll be doing. I'm not retiring per se. It's just time for me to come on home. So that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm focused on. So, I'll be around. And right now it's just, that's where I'm headed. So thank you for the time. And you'll be hearing from me in the future. So thank you guys.
Oh, I'm going to miss Shannon's impression of Andrew Luck. Oh, and Andrew Luck's career. Wish you the best, my dude. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about Dwight Howard going to the Lakers, but first, hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BOMANI. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, so Dwight Howard is playing for your Los Angeles Lakers now, Gabe.
Yes.
How you feel about that, Gabe?
I'm not sure how to feel about it yet. All I can think of is the Sports Illustrated cover with Nash and Howard.
Yes.
Now, this is going to be fun. And now I've seen a bunch of different reproductions of it where it's like, oh, insert Alex Caruso. If anyone knows who Alex Caruso is, the like balding 20-something guy and Dwight Howard on the front. And it's doesn't spell a good future.
I just want to point out to you that Dwight only played 9 games in Washington last year. But the year before, he played 81 games with Charlotte, played 30 minutes a game, and averaged 17-13. In those 9 games he played for Washington, he averaged 13 points and 9 rebounds in 26 minutes a game. He has averaged a double-double for every season of his career. He is a surefire Hall of Famer. He is a guy who, while he wants the ball, does not need the ball in order to be effective. He is a dude that does a bunch of the dirty work that a lot of people don't want to do while playing in the NBA. Like, yo, keep this in mind. Dwight Howard has never averaged more than 13 shots from the field. So he can be out there playing with a bunch of other dudes. Like, it's hard to find a guy who's as good as he's been for as long as he's been who does not require the ball in order to get things done. And nobody likes him. But what's weird about the fact that nobody likes him is nobody ever calls him a jerk. They just don't like him. Like, he is the ultimate tryhard, and a tryhard is very, very difficult to deal with on a consistent basis. But people don't like him to the point where he has signed a non-guaranteed deal with the Lakers, where he got lectured basically by Anthony Davis, Rajon Rondo, a couple other dudes on the team to let them know what they expect of him and basically what they won't tolerate of him. The way Woj termed it was, quote, he's been warned, unquote, and I need you to stop and think about what I just told you. Rajon Rondo, who has not always been the best-liked person in all the other places he has been, is coming in explaining to somebody how you got to act so that other people might like you. Can you think of anybody, literally anybody, who has been in this sort of situation? Because normally the argument is, as long as you can ball, as long as you can produce, people will put up with all kinds of stuff that you are willing to do. Dwight Howard's biggest problem is that he tries too hard and they let him know that will not be tolerated. What? That's where he is. Oh, by the way, this might be a great pickup because, again, when we talk about the actual basketball part of it, what is the argument against picking up Dwight as a basketball player? They were going to try DeMarcus Cousins out there before he got hurt again, and I don't think there's any argument to be made at this point that DeMarcus Cousins would have been a better player for the Lakers than Dwight Howard, in large part because DeMarcus Cousins requires the ball so much. Ain't going to be a lot of shots left for other people with LeBron and Anthony Davis out there. Dwight come out here, set these screens, crash these boards, protect the rim. Yo, this should be, like, if you're a Lakers fan, you should legitimately be looking at this and being like, yo, our basketball team just got better. Except people dislike Dwight so much, they can't even think about it in those terms. Like, I still have to argue with people about whether or not Dwight Howard, 4-time defensive player of the year, probably should have been a 5th time because he got a job that year, they gave it to Tyson Chandler, is a Hall of Famer. It is so, like, really, people will argue you into the ground and explain to you, I need to see more from Dwight before I see whether or not he is a Hall of Famer. How in the world is that possible? And just so you know, basketballreference.com does a Hall of Fame probability calculator. They add in a whole bunch of different factors based on the history of people getting into the Hall of Fame. And they then said for Dwight, all right, is Dwight a Hall of Famer? According to their metric, Dwight Howard's Hall of Fame probability is 99.3%. That's the likelihood of Dwight Howard getting into the Hall of Fame based on his resume. 99.3. And I still got people out here like, no, Dwight Howard is not a Hall of Famer. Just because y'all don't like him. Now, I've always been kind of dismissive of some of the distaste that people have for Dwight because I think a lot of it basically went back to the Stan Van Gundy thing, which I thought was a little bit low from Dwight, but it ain't the end of the world to me. Hell, Stan got over it. So I didn't really think this was going to be that big a deal for anybody else if Stan got over it. No, everybody else stayed mad. What I didn't realize at that time, though, was Kobe was not the only person that just really disliked this dude. Really disliked this dude. And it's got to be confounding for Dwight, because all Dwight is trying to do is make y'all like him. That's been his program from the beginning. I'm just trying to make y'all like me. And they looking at Dwight like, bro, we don't want to like you. We're not interested in liking you. Just not it. We don't want to like you. So how's this going to go for him with the Lakers, right? Oh, but I said another thing before I forget about Dwight. Yo, Dwight left the Lakers. They haven't made the playoffs since. Dwight left Orlando. Took a long time before they made the playoffs again. The Rockets kind of had some ups and downs after Dwight left there, but it wasn't like they suddenly got better because he wasn't on the team. This is a legitimately good basketball player, right? And even the numbers that he's putting up now, this is after that terrible back injury. And he hasn't quite been the same since, but he's still been a more than serviceable NBA player. And nobody likes him. I can't think of a comparable situation to this with him. Like, I feel like Dwight looks up and sees some of these other dudes. Like, I think what Tim Tebow ultimately, like, what he, like, Tebow's an NFL player, wasn't good. But, like, as a personality, as a persona of sorts, I think that's what Dwight saw himself as being, right? He was going to bring Jesus into everybody's life and all of that stuff. Nope. Didn't work that way. Didn't go that way for him at all. He just wanted to be the nice guy that everybody liked, who smiled and who kind of performed for everybody. And then one day everybody looked up and was like, yo, we don't find this to be funny anymore. We just don't. We're not digging it like we used to. This ain't what we're here for.
Do you think part of it with Dwight is jealousy?
I'd imagine somewhat, but I mean, there's a lot of guys in the league to be jealous of. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess my point is that Dwight can eat like 50 candy bars a day and he still looks like he does.
That's a great point. That is a great point. I think Dwight, you know what? Dwight figured like his thing when he was early is I'm just a big old kid. And being a big old kid, I mean, now he is 33 years old. Don't go over the same way. People don't dig it like that. And he never quite adjusted. You remember he did the Lee Jenkins article? You know, everybody did the Lee Jenkins redeem myself article. He did the Lee Jenkins article. That didn't work because people just did not want to hear. That dude went out there and talked about how he had to cut his parents off because they were hitting up his pockets. Like, he actually talked about the fact that, you know, Dwight came in talking about all that Jesus, but he got all these kids, you know, and trying to reconcile his upbringing with the fact that he enjoyed having sex and trying to deal with it, everything that came along with that. I mean, like, he did everything. And y'all just look back like, nah, we don't rock with you like, we just don't rock with you like that. That's all. I just can't think of anything that's like it. I don't even know how much judgment I have for other people and the fact that they feel that way about him, because everybody seems to feel that way about him except for me. I just can't think of anything that's close to it. But I'm telling you, there's a good chance that this is, I'm not saying this thing that puts the Lakers over the top, but the Lakers just got a lot better by getting Dwight Howard.
You're not concerned about spacing at all with Dwight on the floor?
I would be no more concerned about him in spacing than I would be with JaVale McGee.
That's a fair point.
You know, like that's it. So the other reason I'm not that concerned with him on spacing is that he can still get out there and play in the pick and roll. So if his plan was like to stand on the block and wait for people to throw him the ball, okay, then I think we'd have a problem. But he's going to be coming out there on the perimeter to help these guys and spray, you know, running to the rim. And then if it's not there at the rim, then going somewhere else. No, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but this could turn out to be a very significant free agent addition. Like, having him could really make things different for the Lakers. And all there is for us to talk about is how much people don't like Dwight Howard. Damn, homie. Gabe, you do much of the tennis?
I do the much of the tennis.
Okay, you struck me as a guy that might be a tennis fan, but I wasn't sure. I don't really know people's names like that, though. I went to some event in New York last week. It was something Nike did. It was Queens of the Court, I think they called it, and it was a lot of women's tennis players, and they set up at this park on Houston and 6th. And they had a lot of kids there who were tennis players. They filled up the crowd with them, and they got to come out, and they had the chance to, like, hit balls with the players. Like, they ain't get a chance to do it with Serena. Serena came first, Serena waved, Serena dipped. But after that, they got to hit balls with all kinds of players who have won Grand Slams whose names I don't know. Like, they were rattling off resumes for these women, and they were like, yeah, she won Wimbledon in 2017, or she's a three-time Grand Slam champion. I'm like, damn, I wonder who this is. And they say a name I had never heard, and out would walk an Eastern European woman that I had never seen. Like American interest in tennis in that way has just kind of waned, as we don't have that many American tennis players left that are, like, at the height in that way. Although, we've got more of them than I think they get credit for. It's just interesting. They're disproportionately black. Maybe that's part of it. I have no idea. But anyway, I went out to that event, and I didn't know who them people were. And Maria Sharapova was there. It wasn't a rousing ovation, Gabe. It wasn't a rousing ovation. Let's just say the crowd seemed to be much more a Serena crowd than a Maria crowd. You feel me?
I'm with you.
Yeah. It was one of those situations. But anyway, I saw them out there. And then after that, the draw came out, and we had Sharapova and Serena Williams playing in the first round. Now, the game was going on during my birthday dinner. I went to the bathroom at some point, and I saw that the score was 1-1 in the first set. By the time dinner was done, Serena had beat her 6-1, 6-1. And as that last game is in progress, I'm watching Sharapova, or one of the last games, I don't know if it's exactly the last one, but watching Sharapova, and she's got the ball, and she's doing, you know, dribbling the ball before she serves. I don't know if dribbling is the right way to put it, but whatever. I say things as I know them. So she's dribbling, getting ready to serve, and you could just see it in her face. She wanted to cry. And I'm not saying this like, oh, boo-hoo for you. I'm saying this like literally, like she wanted to cry. She looked miserable. She looked as though she was being embarrassed in front of the world. And so here's the thing for me. Clearly, some of y'all out here love Maria Sharapova. And I know that some of y'all love Maria Sharapova because you have to love Maria Sharapova in order to try to sell this idea somehow that Maria Sharapova and Serena Williams are rivals just because Sharapova beat Serena a couple times like 15 years ago. Literally, like a couple times. Like 15 years ago, and not even like a couple times, it is literally a couple times. The like 15 years ago is me guessing because I'm not sure the exact timing on the dates, all right? But off of that, somebody decided that this was a rivalry. What has happened in that rivalry since? Serena has beaten her 19 straight times. 19 straight times. Sharapova has not taken a set off Serena in 10 years. 10 years. And, Gabe, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Serena give her the blues at the Olympics?
I believe so.
Oh, yeah, 2012 Olympics. 6-love, 6-1. Took her out at Wimbledon in the Olympics. 6-love, 6-1. And you know whose fault it is? Y'all's fault. It's y'all's fault. Because Serena wouldn't have to do her like that if y'all wasn't out here trying to act like somehow they were rivals. The need to try to present somebody to have alongside Serena Williams as a rival, that's why y'all in this situation. I don't know. Has Serena beat anybody else 19 times in a row? Is there anybody else that she has this consistently dog-walked in the way she did Maria Sharapova? Do you think that that is strictly about the way that their games match up? Because while Sharapova may be a little overrated, she has 5 Grand Slam titles and she has won the career Grand Slam. All right, like she's not Anna Kournikova or anything like that. But she out here getting dog walked by Serena every single time. Why? Because y'all just don't know how to act. If y'all could just act right and behave with some level of rationality when it comes to things, then this woman would have to get dog walked every time she come out here. But y'all keep trying to make this a rivalry. Therefore, she out here fighting back tears because she knows she going to get embarrassed again. And she has certainly added to this. Like, there was that time that she talked about someone, Serena Williams, as being somebody who dated people's husbands or boyfriends or whatever it was and everything else. Yo, you shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't have said that. All that did was get you more dog walking. And there she was out there. Dog walk. Right? Snatching her by that leash. Come on over here. Just walking her. Like, no, we going this way. No. Stop trying to eat them plants over there. They're going to mess up your stomach. We going this way. Dog walk. Because we needed to come up with some phony notion of a rivalry. Like, at least with Tiger Woods and David Duval, people gave up on that early. Hell, with Tiger and Phil, people gave up on that. This one, people still try to halfway make this into a thing. Like, it shouldn't have all been noteworthy that Serena and Sharapova were playing in the first round of this tournament. That shouldn't have been something I even knew in the first place. But I knew it because people kept trying to make it a thing. And then next thing you knew, poof, poof, dog walk. Had to be done. Do I even have to bring up the... Oh, go ahead, Gabe. I'm sorry.
I was just having a laugh.
Yeah, but do I even have to bring up, like, the uncomfortable part of this, that all of this is centered around race? Like, every single bit of it is centered around race. Like, the contrast is so staggering. Like, Serena Williams, being Serena Williams, being where Serena Williams is from, looking like Serena Williams looks, being built the way that Serena Williams is built, and being as good as Serena Williams is. On the other side, like, Sharapova, who basically looks like the woman that you imagine emerged from the Caucasus Mountains, right? Who has had this career where she has made way more endorsement money than Serena Williams has been treated far differently by the tennis press than Serena was. And never, and don't forget the fact Maria Sharapova got caught cheating and then came up with a cockamamie lie about, I thought I could do this, even though she was taking a medication for years that you're only supposed to take for 6 months at a time.
Okay.
But it feels, and I can't say this directly, but it feels as always they needed some white woman to hold up as a competitor to the dominance, or someone who was on a similar plane as the dominant Serena Williams. And they got somebody that won a couple times. It's like, oh man, we finally got it. And people just couldn't walk away from it. They were still holding on that damn tight. They just could not walk away from it because they needed somebody to be on the same level as this black superstar tennis player that they had. And I was kind of interesting to think about because there always was this one person you could have put on that same level if you wanted to, you know, her sister, who has somehow become wildly underrated over the years. You didn't need Maria Sharapova for this, but we forced it and we forced it and we forced it. And then again, Sharapova, the things you say that get you in trouble. Do you remember that game when Sharapova was talking about how she didn't want to get muscular because she wanted to, like, still look feminine and all that stuff?
Oh, I remember.
I mean, who do we think she was talking about? What do we think that she was talking about? And that stuff on its face doesn't seem so bad, but you have to remember the racism that surrounds Serena Williams, honestly, now is not nearly as loud as it was in the previous decade, right? Like, that was back when you had host of a prominent morning radio show in this country talking about those women and calling them apes. Like, with no compunction, just like being honest, like, just straight ahead. We, not even honest is the wrong way to put it, but you understand what I mean. Like, just literally calling them monkeys, calling them gorillas, like, all of those things, doing that. And nobody got fired for that. Nobody lost their job for doing that. This was just the way that they were treated and they were discussed in public. And again, that being juxtaposed against Maria Sharapova. I don't know fully how much Sharapova consciously was playing into this, but she made a whole lot of money by not being Serena Williams. Like, that was her selling point, was not being Serena Williams. And let me tell you something that we've learned over the years and we damn sure saw in this last dog walking. She damn sure ain't no Serena Williams. She ain't been no Serena Williams before. She ain't gonna be no Serena Williams later. And she ain't no Serena Williams right now. She is not those things. She is Maria Sharapova, and it is cool. Let her be Maria Sharapova, but she is not Maria Sharapova of the Sharapova-Serena Williams rivalry. There is no such rivalry. As I've said many times before, this is a rivalry in the way that the Globetrotters and the Generals have a rivalry. They ain't our rivals. They just play all the time, and that is the case that we have had here, and it has been uncomfortable over the years, but the only thing that honestly has made it tolerable is watching Serena dog walk her every time.
Did you see the Tennis Channel tweet during the match that said, us, maybe this time will be different. Serena, no. Serena takes the first set 6-1. It got like 2,500 likes. And then I saw a bunch of people subtweeting and being like, who exactly is us in this?
Right. it's so insidious, right? Like, it's so subtly thrown in there and worked in there in that way. And see, and this is the thing that gets me. Okay, where's Maria Sharapova from?
Russia.
Where's Serena Williams from?
South Central Los Angeles.
Yes, the United States. How y'all out here rooting for Russia? Like, think about that for a second. Like, that tells you everything. And if there's ever been a great frustration I've had with the way the Williams sisters have been treated, my good buddy Lawrence always makes this point. He was like, the greatest story in 20th century American sports is the story of the Williams sisters. And he has a great argument behind it. I don't even have to fully spell it out for you. But when you really think about where they came from, where they wound up, the fact that people didn't want them there in the first place, all the different things these women have done with their lives and everything outside of tennis and what they've managed to pull off, this is one of the most amazing stories. And like a decidedly American story, right? Like some rags to riches type stuff. They out here hitting tennis balls out of shopping cart in Compton because their dad had a vision that he was going to raise two great tennis players, and the gangbangers are rolling past being like, yo, keep up the good work and all of this stuff. And they got to where they are. And y'all out here rooting for the Russian lady? Like, whoever you happen to be. Knowing how people hacked about waving that USA and that flag and everything else, y'all out here rooting for Russia against the most American story in sports that we could think of. People holding up Russia as a rival to American dominance. When the hell did y'all start doing that? And the answer is, you started doing that when Russia looked like this and America looked like that. It's y'all's fault, Serena, be making that girl cry. All right. It is the finale for us here on the Right Time Book Club. Thank you so much for everybody who's read, everybody who's sending questions, everybody who has contributed. You can check us out again at the hashtag The Right Time Book Club in case you want to catch up. And our book this summer was Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. And with that in mind, joining us today on the show is the author of the book, Mike Freeman. Mike, man, I want to tell you first why I chose this book. I read the book when it came out, and I used it when I taught a class at Duke a few years ago on the Black Athlete in America, and I found it to be very interesting and very even-handed. But part of why I wanted to revisit this book was with our changing attitudes in public about matters, particularly about like violence against women and domestic violence, that Jim Brown is, we've known this about Jim Brown for a long time and just taken it as part of the Jim Brown story. But it was kind of interesting to read back now as our sensibilities have kind of changed, but this Jim Brown story stays the same, you know?
Well, first, I want to thank you for doing this. A lot of us appreciate it. It's really just terrific that you do this. So thank you, first of all. And 100% correct. It's changed. Our sensibilities have changed dramatically. And you know, the one thing, looking back on it, you know, the book has the word hero in it. I don't know if I would use that word now. In fact, I probably wouldn't. In fact, I'm sure I wouldn't. That's how much I think things have changed. And you bring up a good point that we always knew this about Brown. And this goes to, I think, the fault of men and how myopic we can be. And even men who think they have some sort of understanding of domestic violence, who think of themselves as good men, who think of themselves as men that sympathize and empathize and would protect a woman in those circumstances. But even men like us who think of ourselves that way have huge holes because we're men, because we're taught by society a certain way. And even if you are open-minded and think a certain way and are progressive, you still have a huge hole. So in the book, I talk about why I call him a hero, but it's looking back on it, it's just, there's no way I should have done that. And everything that's happened since I wrote that book has dramatically altered our society, altered how we think of things, and altered how I think of how I've written this book. I love revisiting it because I look back on it, and you rarely get times in life to just sort of look back on something and say, I'm going to correct this. I'm going to think of it this way. I'm going to think of it differently. And that's what I've done with this book. So I'm appreciative of you for that. But it's there are parts of it that I look at and I go, oh, I would have done that very differently. And there's very few books I've written where I've done that, or columns, or there's parts of my life I like to revisit, but there's very few books and things I've written that I revisit because I'm like, this is how I feel, and it's sincere, it's from the heart, but this is a huge one of those times where I wish I did not use that word. I don't think he deserves it. And I think there are aspects of him that are absolutely great. But, I mean, and just real quick, like, if you look at Jim Brown's life, you know, we're talking about the one domestic violence part of it, and there's another part of it that is just, to me, just looking back, is just staggering. I mean, Jim Brown goes to Syracuse and is a very openly proud African-American man who was, when he goes to Syracuse, he was told that he couldn't date white women while he was there. He played lacrosse. He talked about racism openly to people on campus, to other people. He was not shy in any way about being a proud African-American man. He goes to the Browns in the late 50s, early 60s. The NFL still has quotas, unspoken of, but they were locked in place, that you can only have 3 to 5 black players on your teams. Brown railed against that publicly, not privately. He did it publicly, and he helped change that policy very slowly. He goes to Hollywood. He's the first black action hero. He fights for the rights and talks, again, openly about black people not having the opportunities in the movies. He goes to L.A. He brokers peace between gangs. He probably saved, not underestimating in any way, he probably saved hundreds if not thousands of lives. The gang members are like, we're going to listen to Jim Brown. We're going to listen to him. He brokered peace at his house. He'd have him at his house. I look at the Jim Brown now, and I can't even recognize him. He doesn't look anything like the guy that I spent years of my life studying and writing about and think of him a certain way. I think what years do is sometimes they change us for the better, sometimes they change us for the worse. Brown is just all over the place. I mean, he's hard to really just put into any kind of category. He's always been that way, but especially now. I mean, this is the picture of him with Kanye West in the White House is just staggering. I mean, to people listening, I can't emphasize enough how dramatically different that is from 30, 40 years ago with Jim Brown. So this book sort of, to me, it just sort of, it's one of the things, it's sort of an example of how we all change and how times change and how some things sort of stay the same and some things sort of, we just don't recognize them anymore. And this is one of those examples. I mean, it's just crazy, some of the stuff that's happened since I wrote that book, but this is one of those examples.
You know, the term hero, and you did explain in the book, like, because it was a very provocative thing to do in the title, but I also thought it was very intellectually compelling at the time that it came out, because, like I've said for a while now, I don't know what we're going to do as media when Jim Brown dies, because there's no encapsulation. Like, there's no paragraph that you can write that spells this out. And so at the time of the writing, and I also thought it was interesting to me in reading back the book, having not read it in about 10 years, the tone that you took when talking about the things, like the violence against women and those things, you didn't pull any punches. Like, you didn't spare him. It wasn't as though you wrote it and were just like, ah, yeah, so he did this one thing, but yeah, whatever. Like, I thought you were very direct about it, but we did treat that as just kind of part of the narrative, because that's what we've always done when it came to Jim Brown. And I don't know, like, if Jim Brown came around now, I don't think it would be possible to do that in that way, which would then be interesting, because what would we then say about the unquestionably great works that he did?
That's a really, really smart point. And if Jim Brown came around now, I don't know. Well, when he arrived on the scene, especially when he got to the Browns, obviously it's a dramatically different America. And he was one of those guys that saw all the racism and was like, screw this, I'm fighting it. He fought it very publicly. Not just with words, but with deeds. He started it was later called the Black Economic Union. That picture, that iconic picture with him and then Lew Alcindor, a bunch of the black star athletes at the time. They were defending Muhammad Ali's decision not to go into the draft. That picture, people should go Google if they don't know what I'm talking about. It's a beautiful picture, but it's all because of Jim Brown. Jim Brown organized the whole thing. He got all the black athletes there to defend Muhammad Ali. That is a very powerful thing. All the things he did like that were very, very powerful. But I don't know. It's different times, so it's hard to just go to draw a straight line. But I don't think that Jim Brown, with his domestic violence history, would be able to exist. He wouldn't have the power to do it, which is ironic because we didn't give domestic violence enough weight, and in some ways we still don't, but especially when he was coming of age, and not giving the domestic violence that weight allowed him to be powerful, allowed him to be a very powerful, strong black man. And now we do give domestic violence that weight, as we should. We condemn people who commit it, as we should. But that also would weaken the Jim Brown today, and it has. So when you bring up that really excellent point about how we describe him and how we write about him and what that core graph or couple of graphs would look like, it would be all over the place because there were parts of him that were absolutely great, and there were parts of him that were absolutely dreadful. And in between, most of us are like that, not to those extremes, but most human beings do some things that they're not proud of and things that they're proud of and things that they do really well and things they don't do well. But he were those extremes on both. I mean, he was polar opposite, and he would do some remarkably brilliant, smart, aggressive things to help people of color. And then he would do things to undermine that. But I don't think that Jim Brown today would have the standing to do that with his domestic violence history. So it would be a completely different Jim Brown today. But he came along at the perfect time for him. He came along at the perfect time for sports, professional sports, for the civil rights movement. He was an athlete who understood how to use his power of an athlete to better the positions or try to better the positions of people of color. And he understood that and he embraced it. So it was a different time for him, no question.
And it's all wrapped up in his refusal, his uncompromising nature, his refusal to apologize, all of that, which leads to the positive things, but of course then compounds the negative. Like, I was thinking about this when Don Newcomb, former pitcher of the Dodgers, died not too long ago. And I read something about him that I did not realize, is that he had savagely beaten his wife while he was a player. He was also a raging alcoholic. But you could find the quotes of him saying, "I was a drunk and an awful man then, and I did awful things." Like, and that's not the deepest right. sentence in the world, but that's kind of the sentence that people need to hear. And that's something that Jim Brown could very, especially at 80 years old at this point, could very easily say is, "I did some awful things," but he has denied all of them.
And I don't think there's, and I read probably 99% of the stories ever written on him. I spent years, that was so much of the research, just reading stuff about him and about some of these really horrific incidents. And I don't, if I remember correctly, I don't think I ever saw him apologize once on about any of that. Going back to decades ago when he had these issues, he was on trial in Cleveland once for domestic violence, for assault. Going back all the way back then, I don't think I ever saw him say, "You know, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that." It's of all the strengths he has, that's one of his greatest weaknesses. And I think it's a weakness of your person who doesn't have introspection, look back at your life, and if you're a public figure, publicly say that what I did was wrong. And when asked about it, that's a, you know, an inherent weakness to me. You need to have introspection. You're not going to be perfect. And you look back at your life and you try to get it better and make things better. He didn't do that. He's unapologetic in every way. Some of that is beneficial. Some of that is really bad. I mean, you know, you do some of the things he did, you just say, "I shouldn't have done that. I'm sorry," but he will not do that. I don't think he's ever done that. I may be missing something, but I don't think he's ever done that. And he never will. I don't think till his dying day will he ever do that. It's just not in his nature. He sees it as weakness. And more than anything, what he wanted to be about was dominating the culture, dominating the era, dominating the football field, dominating the locker room, dominating women. That was who he was. He is. He's unapologetic for it. It's one of his great weaknesses, but that's who he has been his entire life. The one consistent part of him, we talk about all these different ups and downs, these different polar opposites. The one consistent part of him is just not apologizing and just moving forward and just bowling people over. So that's who he's always been, and I think that's who he'll always be.
And that's juxtaposed against his belief in his own honesty, right? Because that's he's one of those guys that brags, you know, whose honesty is his big thing, but the thing he seems not to be able to be honest about is himself.
And one of the things about him that I always found really interesting was just the how he took what he did on the field and just took it off the field in every aspect of his life. Like on the field, he really enjoyed just beating the crap out of people, and people had taken their best shots at him and him keep going. And he took just vicious shots. If you look at some of the tapes, he would just, I mean, the dudes were just were so much smaller than him, but it would be like four or five guys taking their best shots, play after play after play, sometimes five or six, seven, eight shots in one run. It was crazy. So his thought was, that's how I'm going to be off the field. Off the field, take all the shots you want of me. He could be a little thin-skinned sometimes, but mostly he was tough. And he decided, I'm going to just be tough. And no one's going to get to me. I'm not going to apologize. I'm not going to do anything but be tough. That's who I am. And on the field, it obviously worked really well. Off the field, it worked in certain aspects. And off the field, it didn't work in certain aspects. Some of it was very troubling off the field.
Now, one thing I was always curious about, when you were writing the book, what did you come across in the process that really had you like, wow, I had no idea of this until I started doing the research?
It was the Hollywood stuff. You know, when you look at movies now, there's like people of color that are stars all over the place. I mean, people will inherently know this, but it was just when he came about, it was just stark, the lack of people of color in Hollywood, not just on screen, obviously, but off screen, how racist Hollywood still was when he got to it. And the interracial kiss he had with Raquel Welch, one of the first, it was a huge deal. But it was what made it really significant, what made Jim Brown in Hollywood really significant, was just how he was the first black action hero, but he was just the first guy that would openly and constantly talk about race. And, you know, like you talk about race now, people say, why are you always going to talk about race? Shut up about race. And you're sort of, people try to back you down and keep you from talking about it. And then, I mean, it was even more, much, much more hostile, and he didn't care. And he would do interviews with Hollywood media and talk about the inequities in Hollywood. And the other thing is he made a lot of movies. He made a good dozen movies, and one of the things that really surprised me the most is they were all big time profitable. He made movies and people went to see them and people went to watch them. And a lot of people did, and they were profitable. That's why he was able to keep making them. He was able to just, people really liked him. They liked who he was on screen. They liked his personality. Like he was a tough guy. So that the Hollywood part of it really, really surprised me more than anything, because I knew he was in Hollywood. I didn't know it was to that extent. I didn't know he was that well liked by particularly African American moviegoers. I didn't know any of that, and that really, really stunned me because it was very extensive. So I didn't know about any of that. I mean, some of it I didn't know about a lot of it, and he was a very, very powerful player in Hollywood at the time.
You know, the Hollywood stuff is tied to an NFL story that's here, you know, out now with Andrew Luck retiring as suddenly as he did, which was shocking. But can you give people perspective that you got in doing the book of just how shocking and audacious it was to be like, hey, man, I'm over here making the Dirty Dozen. I'm going to just stay.
If you take Andrew Luck and multiply by like 1,000, that's what it was. In the NFL itself, in the league itself, people were just absolutely stunned. He was dominating the league. He was young. He had at least another 5 years. No one saw it coming. He didn't really tell anyone about it, really. He didn't tell the Browns about it until very late. And he was as dominant a force in the history of the league as you will ever see. And he left at the very height of it. And he went... And when he retired, he's shooting The Dirty Dozen, the movie, and he's standing. There's a scene of him where he's talking about retiring, and he's standing in front of this prop tank. and he's talking about, I don't need football. I save up my money. This is bigger. I can have more influence doing this. And at the time, that wasn't really, people thought that was just dumb. Like, why are you leaving the sport? Football wasn't obviously what it is now, but it was still very influential. And the way he was dominating it so much, people thought going to the movies, like, that was stupid. And, of course, he was, because he's a very smart guy, he was two steps ahead of people. He saw how he used his influence in football to change things and to draw attention to race relations. He thought he could do the same in Hollywood, just on a bigger scale. And he was also ahead of his time in terms of the physicality, the toll it took on his body. He was, before people were even talking about this stuff, talking about concussions, head injuries, the long-term effects of football, and he just didn't want to do it anymore. And that way he was, in a lot of ways, he was ahead of his time, but that way also he was ahead of his time. He understood and studied what it did to the body. He just really took it to heart and just said, I'm going to go make movies. And at the time, it was just, I mean, what happened with Andrew Luck now is nothing compared to then. It was a huge national story then, all across every aspect of the culture, from news to sports to Hollywood to everything. So it was a monumental thing what he did.
And if people thought that Andrew Luck, they were entitled to Andrew Luck entertaining them, God knows what they thought they were entitled to from Jim Brown.
I got to say, I'm rarely shocked anymore. I'm sure you're not either. Like, we've seen a lot of stuff. The entitlement people have towards Luck is just like, that just stunned me. I know I shouldn't be, you know, I know I shouldn't be stunned. I was still like, people booing him, people saying, and on it, I'll just be blunt. Usually I see that with African-American athletes, how people think they own them.
Right.
This was one of the first time I saw it with a white athlete. And it was still, I've seen it before all the time, it was still stunning to watch people think that they have some sort of control, or should have some sort of control over the life of an athlete. Like, it, you watch them and you see them on Sunday and you think you control them. And if they don't do what you want, then they're mad at you. That, I mean, if you really just think about that in a vacuum, it's really unbelievably arrogant and stupid. But that's how a lot of people think. And Brown, again, when he did it, there were a lot of really angry fans. You can imagine some of the things they were saying about Brown, and he didn't care. And he just walked away, and he didn't care. And he, you know, in retrospect, he's still considered by a lot of people the best player of all time, and he still has these other marks in the culture and society and history. So of course, he obviously made the right decision because it's what he wanted to do. It's his body. But he also made a really smart decision because he had impacts on multiple fronts. He never saw himself as just as a football player. He saw himself as someone that could change things or talk about changing things. And he was able to do that in Hollywood too. So it was, in the end, it was a smart decision.
And, you know, like, kind of wrap this up, I wanted, at first my thought was to ask questions. So, like, what do we say about Jim Brown now? But I wonder if the ultimate lesson is we got to learn to say more things about people, because we're, like we said before, we're not going to get that core paragraph that explains what he is. Like, this is a guy who, in retrospect, when it comes time to sum this all up, is just going to be like, hey, go ahead and have a seat. This might take a while.
Really, really good point. And I think the way to answer that is, in our profession, sometimes nuance is missing. Sometimes depth is missing. With Brown, you're going to have to sort of say some really uncomfortable things while pointing out all the great things. There are going to be multiple fronts to write about with him, and have been for decades. There will continue to be that way. He helped define the National Football League. He helped define what it meant to be a black actor. He helped define those things. He also helped define, in a lot of ways, or point out our weakness when it comes to addressing domestic violence. I think that's changed a lot. So now we're armed, especially men, with these sensibilities. So when you look at his legacy, the sensibilities that we didn't have 20 years ago, we have now. It will cast his legacy in a completely different light, and there will be very, very good things and very, very bad things. And your point is really well taken, because that's okay. I mean, not the domestic violence part obviously isn't okay, but our addressing the weaknesses of human beings is what kind of what you should do when you're doing these type of evaluations of a guy. I mean, this is how you address a multidimensional person, because most people are that way. They're multidimensional. He's very much that way. So it's okay to talk about, and encouraging to talk about, his weaknesses, because it humanizes him and it humanizes us. But that's going to be his legacy. His legacy is going to be very, very complicated, and some of it's going to be very ugly, and some of it's going to be really remarkable. But this is who he is. This is who he's always been. This is Jim Brown. This is the guy who helped define a league, helped define the 60s and 70s of Hollywood, helped broker peace between gangs, helped do all these different things, and also had this really ugly side. So all of that's going to be accounted for. We'll all be talking about that forever. So all of it comes into play, and that's the way it should be.
All right, that is Mike Freeman. Check him out at Bleacher Report. He is also the author of Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero. That's the book we did this summer, and I think we all had a great time going through it. I mean, like, we did the book club last summer, and it was good, but I think this led to a depth of discussion with all the people that we had on. So I thank you for contributing that piece of work, sir.
I thank you. Really appreciate what you're doing, and you're just one of the most talented guys in the business, so keep doing what you're doing, and really appreciate you.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on The Right Time. I do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to Mike Freeman for joining us to talk about the book. Also, thanks to our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. Be sure to check out the Woj Pod this week. He chats with Ramona Shelburne about her 30 for 30 podcast, The Sterling Affairs. Remember to subscribe to The Right Times wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater, and we'll talk to you in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.